This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Imagine a world without trees, and then their first arrival. A team of scientists have painstakingly analyzed the remnants of ancient trees. Nature's first attempt to build tall living towers, all from carbon, was difficult, and it was strange. Trust me, trees changed Earth more than you know. Answers have been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is Unique Growth Strategy in the Earth's First Trees, revealed in silicified fossil tree trunks from China. The lead author is Honghe Xu from the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Nanjing. Our guide in this program is co-author Dr. Christopher Berry. He's a senior lecturer in paleobotany at Cardiff University in the UK. From Wales, Chris Berry, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Touring around in your past publications, you seem to me to be a detailed man and certainly a tree detective. When did you set out on that trail and why?
I can't really explain it. I got interested in paleontology when I was a kid. My father took me out collecting fossils. So I had an inbuilt interest in fossils, particularly finding shelly fossils and animals. And then I studied mainly maths, physics, and chemistry at school, and I went off to university. I went to Cambridge University to do physics, and I hated every minute of it. So I looked around for something else to do, and I decided I would also take a course in geology. I listened to some lectures by Simon Conway Morris on paleontology and met a few interesting people, including Harry Whittington, the great Burgess Shale fossil man, and I became a paleontologist.
So before we get to your latest science, which has landed in major newspapers, I'd have to say, I'd like to step back to a previous stunning article where you were a co-author. I'm talking about the 2015 paper whose title starts out, Investigating Devonian Trees as Geoengineers of Past Climates. Could you unpack that for us, starting with the Devonian, and then how early trees could massively change the climate on Earth? But take as long as you need to do that, Chris.
Well, I didn't write that paper. The person who wrote the paper, Jenny Morris, is in the office just across the corridor from me. But I was very much involved in setting up that project. What we're trying to do is not just look at trees as fossils, but trees as organisms impacting with the environment. And so what we looked for were sites that we could go to and investigate fossil soils, which had evidence of trees growing in them. And we'd start working on geochemistry of the soils, just look at the soils, see what the impact of the plants were on the soils. In particular, there was a very interesting place in upstate New York, quite near the famous Gilboa Fossil Forest, where we could see massive rooting systems which were formed by some of the earliest woody trees that came just after the sort of things that we'll probably be talking about, as well as some of these cladozoolopsid trees as well. This enabled us to literally drill down into the soils, the fossil soils beside these trees, and see where the roots are going, see what they were up to, and to look at the geochemistry of what was going on. The paper that you just mentioned is a preliminary paper, so we haven't published yet the results for that, but I think they're going to be quite interesting and quite detailed in terms of geochemistry and so on. The reason for being interested in soils and plants is because plants not only absorb carbon directly, I think most people would realize that plants are formed out of carbon, and if you squash them on geological timescales, they turn into coal. But plants also absorb carbon from the atmosphere by an indirect route, whereby the action of roots, root hairs, and fungi associated with the roots and the whole root ecosystem takes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and reacts it with the silicate minerals and water and produces carbonic acids. And that carbonic acid is in solution now. The carbon is effectively in solution in the ions, and this can be washed through through the groundwater into rivers and wash downstream into the sea. And there the carbon finds itself being used by shelly animals, micro animals or shelly animals like clams and so on. And it becomes calcium carbonate in the shells of these animals. And thereby it can be incorporated into limestones and be locked into the rock record. So that carbon started off as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has by this long tortuous route involving plant roots being taken down and locked into the seafloor, and therefore carbon dioxide is pulled out of the atmosphere. So that's really the system that we're trying to investigate there. It's obviously quite well known in the modern day, and we were in this work trying to take it back and really examine the impact of Devonian trees on soils and soil geochemistry.
And your work has hovered around the time trees began, and my mind has a little trouble imagining Earth without trees, but apparently they are relative newcomers. It must have been kind of a flat landscape without trees. What was there before them?
Well, there were smaller and smaller plants as you go back into the early parts of the Devonian and into the Silurian before that. And there's some debate about whether there were land plants during the Ordovician and even the Cambrian, going back nearly 500 million years. There's fragmentary evidence that suggests that there were perhaps things on land producing spores quite early on, but those would have been very, very small plants indeed, less than an inch or two high probably. But most likely there were green layers of slimy algae, bacterial mats and things like that for quite a while before land plants got invented. There were some very strange sort of giant fungi, some of which have really quite enormous trunk-like fossils found in the early parts of the Devonian, which may have been the first things that vaguely look like trees, but they're really the stalks of giant mushrooms or something like that. They weren't land plants in the sense that we know them today.
It's an almost magic world that you're talking about. Now, what is the basic engineering challenge nature faced as trees struggle to evolve?
Well, there's a variety of different things. First of all, to get land plants to grow at all, they need to have a coating on the outside, a cuticle, which means that they can control gas exchange. They need to have little pores called stomata to literally control on a moment-to-moment basis gas exchange and to stop water loss. They need roots, but most of all, they really need structural tissues, particular types of cells which give the plants strength to stand up, and they're reinforced with a biopolymer called lignin, and so they have quite thick walls, and as well as conducting water, they will help support the plant. So it's growing cells like that that's important. Even little plants can usually grow these types of cells. What you need to do to be a tree is to learn to grow them in a sort of continuous manner and continue to produce them so that you can enlarge the trunk, so the crown of the tree can grow upwards into the sky. We're used to seeing that in normal trees. When you cut a tree down, you see a set of concentric rings, usually, depending on your climate. But usually there's a set of concentric rings called tree rings. We're used to seeing that. And that shows the addition year by year of extra xylem cells in rows around the outside of the tree. And those xylem cells are produced by a layer of dividing cells called the cambium, and that occurs just underneath the bark of the tree.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Chris Berry from Cardiff University. This is Radio EcoShock. And moving to your new paper published this October in PNAS, you've said the earliest trees used kind of a crazy, I think that was the word used, kind of construction method to do this? What were they like?
Well, it's very complicated and it's quite hard to explain in words over the radio, but I'll give you a shot at it. Just underneath the outer surface of the trunk, which in the lower part was covered in little rootlets going downwards towards the soil, just underneath that layer there were up to a couple of hundred small rods of this xylem material, which are individual rods in a ring. And each of these rods is about the size of a pencil, and each one of those had its own cambium around the outside, and so it was producing tree rings on an individual basis. So when you look at the section of the trunk, you just see a big ring of these little strands with its own growth rings. So it looks like 200 tiny little trees all growing in unison. But that's a simple part of the plant. Just inside that, forming a layer about 5 centimeters thick on a trunk, which may be in itself 50, 60, or 70 centimeters in diameter, forming a layer about 5 centimeters thick, there's a series of interconnected xylem strands, which are a little bit smaller, but they form a sort of structural lattice or truss-like network connecting the outer straight strands together and interconnected one to another to form this amazing sort of diamond pattern. So you can imagine something a bit like inside the tree, if you could see through it with X-ray specs, you'd see a structure that was a bit like a round version of the Eiffel Tower with a hollow center and then this amazing network of xylem strands around the outside and then straight xylem strands on the very exterior of the trunk part of the plant. So it was a plant that was extremely well engineered to be light, hollow, tall, strong, but made out of wood that was just so interconnected together, it was very, very hard for us to imagine that it could actually change shape, that it could grow.
And what was new in the remnants that were found in China?
So we're used to seeing this type of fossil, particularly in the Gilboa Fossil Forest in upstate New York. This is a wonderful deposit that's been known for many, many years. It was worked extensively in the 1920s when a quarry was being built for a dam being made in Gilboa. And in that quarry, you get big trunks or bases of exactly the same sort of tree, the cladozoolopsid trees. However, these are preserved as sandstone casts. So you can imagine the tree standing there 385 million years ago, quite happy, and then the entire forest of the trees has been buried in sand to a depth of about 1 meter. And the trees have subsequently died. The insides have rotted. The very inside was hollow anyway. And then the tree base has been filled up by sand. So in Gilboa, although you have hundreds of fossils of these tree bases, all you see is a big sandstone cast and some very thin remains of this incredibly complicated xylem system. And when you look at it under microscope, when you make sections of it, occasionally you see some cells, but you never see any detail of what's been going on within the plant. The amazing thing about the Xinjiang fossils is that they are preserved in silica. So they've been swamped by what seems to be volcanic sand or ash, and the highly mobile silica from that sand and ash has been incorporated into water. It's dissolved in water, been washed into the plant, and then reprecipitated within the cells so that you can see every single cell of the bottom of the trunk just as fresh as on the day that it died. And that's what's remarkable about these fossils. And that's the really incredible thing. So what we see is that the soft tissues, the little round spherical parenchyma soft cells between the xylem strands have been proliferating. They've been increasing in number. And in increasing in number, they probably produced the pressure to push the xylem strands apart and to increase the diameter of the trunk. So that's one really important observation. However, I've described to you this xylem skeleton as being an extremely strong structure tied together by many cross connections. In order to make that bigger, you would have to start to tear it apart. And what we see is that at the interconnections of the various xylem strands, where they've been put under tension by the expansion of the trunk, that the connections have literally started to tear. So you can see them pulled apart, and you can see the fact that the ring of cambium, which is producing new xylem cells around the tearing strands, has remained intact and continue to divide and produce new wood, even though the connection between the two is being ripped apart at the same time. So it's sort of ripped apart and self-healed at the same time.
A tree that rips itself apart to grow.
It rips its internal skeleton apart in order to be able to grow, but at the same time, it heals it. And it's slightly more complicated than that at the base, because the base is tied to the ground, and as the trunk above it expands, the sides of the trunk actually bend outwards and roll out across the ground to produce a large flat base about a meter across. So the bottom 50 centimeters of the trunk growing upwards ends up flattened out onto a big 1 meter diameter trunk base on the ground. So it's just remarkable. I'd never have thought that such a thing was possible, but we've seen all the evidence to support this idea.
In that earlier paper, it said that mineral changes brought in the soil by tree roots ultimately caused, quote, a 90% decline in atmospheric CO2 levels through the Paleozoic. With the warming gas CO2 tumbling like that, did early trees create the conditions for an ice age?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because what you would expect is that if you reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by that amount, which is what some models suggest, and there's a bit of empirical evidence to support that, then you would expect large decreases in global temperatures. And I guess today we're worried about little changes of a few percent here and there and what that might do in terms of global climate. So these trees, if they were really geoengineering the atmosphere, then you'd really expect that. But the answer is a little bit more complicated, in fact. I speak for the results of some modeling done by colleagues in Paris and in France on atmospheres through the Devonian and other factors which influence climate. And I also would mention some wonderful maps by Chris Scottese and Art Bucco, which are found on www.scottese.com, in which they show where climatically sensitive sediments are found on the Earth through geological time. So, for example, they show where you find sand dunes for deserts and you find evaporites, which suggest hot temperatures, and so on. And they've mapped these across the world. And what the Devonian seems to show to us is that not much changes in terms of where climatic boundaries are on the Earth. So you don't get big changes in the climate through most of the Devonian. Now, the modelers in Paris have produced models which suggest that, in fact, plants have the capability to warm up the Earth. So the very presence of these trees, rather than simply bare rock, is enough to absorb more of the solar radiation just because of their presence, their greenness, their physiology, their roughness, everything that's going on with the plants. It absorbs heat from the sun. So at the same time you've got carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dropping, you're also growing more and more trees which absorb more heat. So there's a good case to be made for the fact that much of the Devonian is quite stable in terms of temperature and climate in that sense, but that the atmosphere is changing in composition. At the very end of the Devonian comes the first evidence of a south polar glaciation. So So there's a short glaciation then. And then we're into the Carboniferous, where, as you know, there's a lot of limestone formed at the beginning of the Carboniferous. And then the coal forests appear towards the middle of the Carboniferous. Those coal forests were, by definition, creating lots of coal, sucking even more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And by the time you get these huge forests and huge coal fields, then we're into a proper glaciation. A lot of my colleagues would use the Carboniferous as a good analogy for today, because what you have is a system where you have large equatorial tropical forests. You have a landmass at the southern South Pole, much like Antarctica, which allows the buildup of big ice sheets. And you have carbon dioxide, which approximately is the same level as today. So the Carboniferous is a good analogy for the present-day world as well.
And what you've just said stimulates me to think about the Gaia hypothesis presented by James Lovelock, and it sounds like trees altered the chemistry of the soil and the atmosphere to better suit their needs, maybe hydrology too. Do you think life is an active regulator on this planet?
I've long pondered this, and I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's an incredibly good idea, and it particularly tells us that, you know, we got to be careful with disturbing that sort of natural balance of things. I just maybe tell you something which slightly argues against that, in that my poor Cladozoilopsids died out, and they died out about the end of the Devonian, the very beginning of the Carboniferous. And there may be some influence of temperature there. They may not have been very capable of coping with frost. They had large soft apices, which, a bit like palm trees, probably couldn't cope with frost. But they weren't what they were at the end of the Devonian as they were in the middle of the Devonian. And I suspect that my trees, my Cladozoilopsids, they didn't have leaves. They had little twiggy-like appendages rather than big, flat, green leaves. And those twiggy bits were probably photosynthesizing. They were absorbing carbon dioxide through stomata. And the carbon dioxide levels were so high in the Devonian that they could do that perfectly efficiently without having proper leaves. And it may be the fact that they, amongst other plants, sucked much of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that made them energetically unable to perform as they did when carbon dioxide levels were higher. So they may have sort of hastened their own demise by changing the conditions of the Earth to an atmosphere which they really couldn't tolerate. So they may have done themselves in, or at least done themselves no favors. That's not to say that other plants didn't then evolve, such as ones with leaves and with big woody stems, and in fact take over from them in a sort of a gradual way. And those plants then became the ones which were regulating the atmosphere and so on. So plants didn't become extinct, but my lovely Cladozoilopsids, I'm afraid they...
You know, your description sounds perfect for our current situation as humans, something that changes the atmosphere to a point where it can't survive it. But we'll let that drop for now. But I do have one other impression from your new paper in PNAS, and that is that nature can be a kind of do-it-yourself garage mechanic rather than the godlike designer we often imagine. Would you call these first trees a clumsy attempt?
No. These were beautiful trees. These were some of the finest trees ever. I mean, they were just great-looking things, and they lived for 30 million years. Now, tell me that the human race will survive for 30 million years, and I'll maybe disagree with you. These plants were absolutely adapted to the conditions in which they grew in, that they made the world into, and they were very, very successful. However, they were extremely complex and extremely bizarre, and one of the challenges is to understand the evolutionary history of them before they become very obvious in the fossil record. There must have been some strange things going on with plants to allow this particular form of growth to become the dominant one, because normal trees that we see today just seem so much more of a simple idea. A single cambium around the outside growing a big trunk seems like a really sensible way of being a tree. So I think of these trees as great experimenters, but ultimately very, very successful and very well designed.
Well, just like those primitive trees, science has to deconstruct itself to grow larger. What are your next questions, Dr. Chris Berry?
That's a very good that's a very good question. I intend to try to find out more about this particular time, and I want to take my research back a little bit in time, because I am interested in what came just before these trees. What were the precursors? What was the world like just before these trees evolved? So hopefully the next item on the agenda is maybe an expedition to the north coast of Spitsbergen to try and pick up fossil plants that are 4 or 5 million years older than the first of the cladozoolopsid trees that I've described to you, and to find out more about the environments and the plants that were alive at that time.
We've been talking with Dr. Chris Berry from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Cardiff University in Wales. He's the co-author of a new paper in PNAS revealing the big role of the big vertical players, the first ones in the plant scene, the ancient trees. You can find links to helpful articles and the abstract in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.